My name is Fran Drysdale, and I'm a grateful, recovering Al-Anon.
Hi.
I belong to the Bessemer, Alabama Al-Anon Family Group, and it's a wonderful group, and I go on a regular basis, and I hope I always will. I want to thank the committee for inviting Jim and me to be with you this weekend. It has been a very special weekend. I have never been treated so much like royalty. So many lovely things have been done for us. I especially want to thank Marge and George, our long, long-time friends. I have had fun knowing Valerie and JC. We had fun having dinner together. And we do have a lot of things in common. I want to thank Dot and Patty for the wonderful talks they gave us on Thursday night and Friday night. I think I realized at that time, even though we're different in some ways, we are alike in so many ways. When we got sick enough and hurt enough, we wanted something better. We wanted some peace in our lives and some serenity. And in that way, we're all alike. This is a big crowd. I guess this is one of the largest crowds I've ever talked before, so I'm a little nervous. I hope you'll stick in here with me. Valerie said that her butterflies were not in formation. And that explained exactly how I was feeling. They'd just gone haywire. I think they're drunk. I will have to tell you my story as we are told to tell it, what I was like and what happened and what I am trying to do with my life now. I was one of those lucky kids who grew up in a wonderful home. No wonder I got in trouble. I had a really great mom and dad, one brother, and they were especially good to us. My mother was a school teacher. She was very strict with both of us. She had rules that we had to follow. We followed them through love of them because they were so good to us. I can remember one birthday, my mom and dad moved all the furniture out of one big room so we could dance. I don't think I'd do that for my kids. My dad cooked hamburgers for the whole party. They did special things like that for us. And I can remember my mom saying, "Honey, don't ever date a boy who drinks. It might cause you some unhappiness." That is ironic. I tried very hard to follow her directions, and I was a little bit picky about the boys I dated. So when I was in college, one of the boys that I was dating from Auburn, some of you may have heard of Auburn, I found out that he drank beer once in a while, and I cut that relationship off instantly. I finished college when I was barely 20, and I was offered two jobs. I was offered a job teaching school for $85 a month. This was in the 40s. Or I was offered a job as a program director in a USO club in Anniston, Alabama. And they offered me $150 a month and the use of a car. So you know what I took. And as I worked in the USO club, I saw hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of fellas going to war come through our club. And I made a resolution, and you'll see how firm I am in my resolutions, that I was not going to get involved with any of these fellas on their way to war. I wanted no heartbreak. I would be nice to them, and I would talk to them, and I'd try to cheer them up, and I would arrange dances for them and movies and all these things, but I was not going to get involved. And 6 months after I met Jim Drysdale, we were married. And he was on his way to war. We had 4 months together before he went overseas. When he went that summer, he left on D-Day, and he was going to Europe. And I couldn't imagine not being married to Jim. That's what I wanted more than anything. He had a very rough time overseas. He was wounded. He was captured by the Germans and was a prisoner of war for a while. I received telegrams from the government that he was missing in action, and then finally that he was a prisoner of war. Those were days that we just lived through. We just got through because we had to. And at this time, I was expecting our first baby. I didn't even know it when Jim left to go overseas, but I was. A little girl was born to us, and she was almost a year old when Jim got home. Now, Jim was one of these clean-cut young men that my parents approved of. He did not drink, and he did not even smoke. He was a nice fella. I remember thinking while he was overseas, I bet he'll start smoking while he's over there. He didn't. Still never has smoked a cigarette in his life. But boy, was he drinking. And I had no idea what to do about it. I knew nothing about alcohol. I'd never been around anybody who drank. I knew absolutely nothing. I didn't even know the word alcoholism. The nearest thing that I had ever learned was in a textbook in a sociology class. You learn a lot in books, you know. I'll tell you, that's about all I did know. I didn't know much about life. I can remember my kids saying to me, "Mom, you're so naive that you think the happy hooker is a story about a happy lady who makes rugs." And that's about the way I was. I'd gone to a girl's school. I just didn't know anything. Unless it was in a book. And they didn't have a lot of books then, they have now to learn out of. This part in this textbook talked about the alcoholics on Skid Row in Chicago. And I got a mental picture of these fellas sitting on the curb in a dirty old torn undershirt with a bottle of wine. And that's what I thought an alcoholic was. That's all I knew. So I did not attach it to Jim in any way. He went to work every day and wore a suit and tie and went to church on Sunday. He couldn't be that, you know. He couldn't be one of those dirty alcoholics. So I decided, hey, you know, you don't have to worry about this. You can fix it. Now, Ernie told you last night that I was going to tell you how many Al-Anons it took to change a light bulb. Well, I'm not. That is one of our Al-Anon secrets. Okay, I said to myself, I will fix this man. I'm just going to give him a little time to settle down from this terrible experience that he's been through, and then I know I can fix it. I had always been able to fix things because I was willing to work hard. I had studied hard because my parents expected me to. I was not afraid to tackle this thing. And I want you to know, in the next 17 years, I did everything you can think of to fix it. I know some of you know. Some of you have been on the receiving end of that fixing. And some of you have been fixers. I tried bad things and I tried good things. And I didn't realize that all this was changing me. I became a very, very good liar. I could lie to the boss without a flinch. My husband was sick and couldn't make it. I was an enabler and did not know it. If he wrote a bad check, I picked it up. I did not want anybody to know that I married somebody who drank too much. So I kept it a secret. Of course, I didn't think about what the neighbors thought when he came in sideways on the driveway. I'll tell you what. Insanity was not a hard word for me to accept when I got in this program. I did so many crazy, insane things trying to regulate this man. I would scream. I would yell. I would say two fairly intelligent people ought to be able to sit down and talk this thing out. So we had regular talks. And I would tell Jim what I expected, and he would agree. That was fine. That was just right with him. Right. And every time I believed it would be different. And I would think, boy, this is great. All I had to do was tell him. Why didn't I do that, you know? Now, I just need to emphasize it a little, you know. And 3 days later, 1 week later, whatever it took, we were back in the same old buggy again. But we would have another talk. And he would always agree with anything I suggested. And every time, I believed it. It's no wonder I got so sick. I believed him. Everything he said, I believed him. I believed a lot of his excuses because I wanted to believe them. I was in a state of denial. I could not accept things the way they really were. And I didn't take the time to look at them. I wouldn't. I didn't want to look at the truth. I didn't want to know the truth. I was teaching school at this time. And we get so conniving ourselves, it's not believable. I decided that I wanted to sit up and wait and see what time he got home. But I didn't want him to know I was sitting up waiting to see what time he got home. So I set up the card table right near the door where he'd have to come in. And I'd get out all my school papers, and I would grade papers and grade papers and grade papers. I had the best kept up papers in the whole school. I was always right up with everything. No wonder I was a successful teacher. Okay. This one night, I was just grading papers, and the children were asleep. We had three children by this time. Our oldest daughter, who was born while Jim was overseas, Jane, and then a son, Jim, and another little girl, Jody. They were wonderful, happy children, and they grew up in Alateen. This night, I was grading those papers, and the telephone rang. And I went to the phone, and this burly voice said, "Calling you to tell you we've got your husband in jail." In jail? I never had even known anybody who was in jail. I just plain was not about to believe that. So I walked the floor, and I thought, now what could have happened to him that somebody would have called me and told me he was in jail? So I decided that he had been kidnapped. He was about 250 pounds by that time, I expect. But I decided he had been kidnapped. So I called this fella, one of his salesmen, and I told him what had happened. And he knew Jim maybe better than I did. And he said, "Friend, you just go on to bed now and just forget about it. He'll be home in a few hours." And I said, "No, I am not going to do that. I have to go see if he's safe. I am going out to that jail." And he said, "Well, it's 1:30 in the morning." And I said, "Well, I'm still going." And he said, "Well, if you're going anyway, just wait there and I'll come and get you and drive you out there. I don't want you going by yourself." So I checked the children and they were all asleep. And I went out the front door with this man at 1:30 in the morning. I hope the neighbors weren't looking out their windows. But I was never thought of that. And we went to the jail. And the jail was a strange building. It had windows on the outside all the way to the ground. And the weeds were about up to my knees, and they were wet. And I walked all around that jail, stopping and looking in the window, looking for Jim. And walking a little more and looking in the window, looking for Jim. And I walked round and round till I finally found him, passed out in his coat and tie. A gentleman to the end. I was right at home with insanity. Had no trouble with it at all. But I didn't know it at the time. I think back on those years. They weren't all bad. We had some really good times because we loved each other. We loved our children. We did a lot of things that were fun. And I patterned some of the things I did after my parents because they were so much in love and so happy together and we had such a happy home. And my mom and dad would take their checks each month and my mom would sign her name to hers and hand it to my dad and he would put it in a joint checking account. And there was always money to pay all the bills. There was always money to take us on nice vacations, buy us new clothes. We went to church and Sunday school every Sunday. We went out to eat. We did a lot of fun things, and I thought, that's the kind of family I want. So I just automatically patterned many of the things I did after my mother. So I signed my check and handed it to Jim. And you know, there was not enough money even to go around all the time. And I thought, I must be spending more. I just had no idea how much Jim was spending on drinking. I didn't realize that it cost so much. Once in a while, the lights would go out, and I would have a fit. And Jim would hurry down and pay the lights, you know. I don't know if any of you ever went through any of that or not. But we went through that sort of time. But I didn't make any changes in anything I was doing. I didn't know I was doing anything wrong. One Monday morning, I was at school. Things had gotten really bad between us. A sort of invisible wall was growing between us, and we were getting to the place where we didn't communicate very well. I knew things were getting worse and worse. But I didn't want to face it. I didn't want to call a halt. I did not want a divorce. I didn't talk to anybody about this except my mother. And she would say, I don't understand. You can get a divorce. You don't have to live like that. That was her answer, the only answer she knew. But I did not want a divorce. I wanted him to quit drinking. And then everything would be all right. Everything. This Monday morning, the secretary from the school office came in my room and she said, get your purse, there has been an accident. Now, I knew instantly that it had happened to Jim because, you see, things had gotten so bad that I kept the insurance payments paid no matter what. That came out of the grocery money if necessary. Because I was absolutely sure this man was going to have an accident. You couldn't drive around drunk the way he did all the time and not have an accident. My one real fear here was that he might kill somebody else. But I wasn't too concerned about him getting killed at this point. Not as much as I should have been. In fact, I had sort of started wishing for an accident. And I had even looked at the high back stairs to see if I could string dental floss from step to step. Now, this is a girl who had been brought up right. And I was scared to do that because I was scared he'd break both his legs and then they'd catch me and then I'd have to look after him till he got well again. So I gave that up. But I was sort of wishing, you know. I said, I know it was an automobile accident. And she said, no. Jim was cleaning his gun, and he shot himself. And we had never had a gun. And I knew that it was not an accident. It was the strangest feeling to realize that Jim had reached a point that he could not face another day. I was frightened. I was full of guilt. I had wished for this, not this particular thing, but this had been part of my unconscious thinking here, and I immediately felt guilty. And when I saw him, I knew that I did not want this man to die. I wanted him to get well. I spent a lot of time on my knees in the chapel during that week when he was not conscious and he would come and go. and we did not know if he would make it or not. He had not been fooling around. He had aimed for his heart and had missed it just a little bit. When he came to and could talk to me, he told me that he knew alcohol was at the base of all his trouble, and that he was never, never going to drink again. And I believed him. And I believed him particularly because logic told me that you do not try to kill yourself unless you're serious about something. And this time was going to be different. It had to be. I felt like I had come off a long slide and had finally gotten to the end. And I was relieved. And I was glad. You know, I had tried all those good things that women do, too. I had bought real fancy negligees and had been just real loving and sweet and cooked him his best dinners. But that didn't matter. I mean, he got drunk anyway. Sometimes he passed out in the negligee. That didn't help my ego one bit. You know, even though I had had such a strict upbringing, I remember one time when I decided I'd try to join him. Oh, we're so crazy. I decided that maybe if I couldn't get him to quit, then I could learn to drink enough that he would drink at home and we could be sociable. So I tried it one time. We had this other couple over who were very, very close friends of ours, and I said to Jean, "Have you ever been drunk?" And she said, "No." And I said, "I haven't either, but let's see if we can get drunk one time." So I told Jim about it, and Bob, Jean's husband, and they looked at each other, and they said, "We're not taking you out anywhere if you're going to act like that." So we set up the card table again, and we were playing cards, and I was drinking, and Jean was drinking, and she was even more straight-laced than I was. And after a while, Jean said, "That's all for me. I cannot swallow another drop." And I said, "Give it to me." And I finished mine, and I finished hers, and I thought, "I'm going to find out about this thing. Is it as great as they say?" And I want you to know, as soon as Jean and Bob left, I was the sickest gal you ever saw in your life. I sat on the floor of the bathroom with my arms around the toilet bowl almost all night. And I can remember looking up at Jim and saying, "Do you do this on purpose?" That was the end of my trying to join. I had always been the one who would take the drink and take a sip and go to the bathroom and empty it down the sink. Or I would hide it behind a plant. Or I would get rid of that thing as fast as I could because I couldn't stand it. Couldn't stand the taste of it. So I learned my lesson in short order that night. During this last year or two of Jim's drinking, some of the teachers in the school where I was teaching came to me and said, "Fran, we're going to go to graduate school, and you have a station wagon, so why don't you come go with us and we'll go in your station wagon?" I said, "Fine, I'd like that." So I asked my mom and dad if they'd come over and keep the children, and they were delighted I was going back to graduate school. So we went, and we had such fun. I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed that. Nobody took a drink. Everybody was laughing and singing and carrying on and talking and having fun. And we went to class, and I thoroughly enjoyed that. I always loved to go to school. And I had so much fun that when the next session started, I went to it. And when that one was over, I went to the next one. And then when summer came, I went to the two summer sessions. And it was just fun. I'm so glad that I had that chance to put my energies in that direction, because I could have gotten into some serious trouble. I was open for some serious trouble. But thank God it worked out the way it did. I think my guardian angel was looking after me. You know, I stuck in there until I got a master's degree. And I didn't start out to get a master's degree. I just didn't want to give up my night out. So when they gave me my master's degree, They gave me $50 a month more money. And back in the 50s, that was a lot of money for a raise for a month. So in my mixed up logic, I thought, Jim Drysdale's not getting this $50 to drink on. I am going to do something with this money so he can't touch it. So I went out looking for what I could buy. And I found a house that was on sale, a beautiful brick house. The den had one whole wall made of marble and a big fireplace. It was really a pretty house. And that was before houses went sky high. And with the payment on the house we were making that at that time, plus my $50, I could make payments on this house. So I bought it. And see, my $50 was all safe. Now, that's the way I was thinking. But that was a good thing that the guardian angel led me to do, too. It was a good investment. Well, back to the hospital. Jim got out in 2 or 3 weeks. And that summer, we spent a lot of time walking over the hills out where we live. And we started talking together. And I thought, everything's going to be all right. And then we'd go back home, and Jim would sit in the den and stare out the picture window into the garden and never smile. And I thought, good heavens, is the rest of our life going to be like this? I'd almost rather he'd be drunk. It was awful. He was so miserable. I didn't know anything about dry. I just knew he was miserable. But I didn't think about him drinking. This had all happened in April. In July, he was going out by himself for the first time. He was going to a baseball game in Birmingham. And it got to be 11 o'clock, and he was not at home. And pretty soon the phone rang, and this voice said, "Honey, I'm going to bring you some lasagna." You know how we know on the telephone? Boy, there was no way. This man was drunk. He had promised me he wouldn't. You know, and terrible thoughts started coming in. Hey, you're going to have to go through all this all over again. And I thought, there's no way. I can't handle it anymore. I'll be as crazy as a bat if I try to handle it anymore. And I knew for the first time that I had to get a divorce. I had 3 children to bring up and educate. There was not any way I could start through that insanity again. And I didn't tell Jim that. The next morning, I got up early, and I got dressed. I was going to the family lawyer. I didn't have to tell him. I don't know how he always knew what I was thinking. But he said, "Fran, if you'll wait about going to the lawyer, there's one more thing I'd like to try. My doctor told me about AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and he knows a man who's been sober 2 years. I didn't think I needed it because I didn't think I was an alcoholic, but I'll go if you stay." That's sort of what I wanted, some kind of a miracle. I didn't want a divorce. I wanted somebody to make him stop drinking. So he went to AA that night, and he came back with a little handful of literature, and we sat cross-legged on the bed and read it out loud to each other. And I remember thinking, some of this sounds a little like church. I believe this will work. And I said, "Oh, Jim, when can I go too?" And he said, "They don't allow women down there." But you see, I had been listening while he was telling me about it, and I said, "What about this Ada and this Peggy you mentioned?" And he said, "Ada keeps the books and Peggy does the dishes." And it was a long time later when he told me that he didn't want to get me involved until he knew whether or not it would work with him. And after about 6 weeks, he let me go. There was no Al-Anon in Bessemer at that time. This was 1961. Later in that year, we got Al-Anon. But I went to open meetings of AA. There must have been less than 20 people in the whole club. And when somebody new came in, oh, it was hallelujah all the way. But they would whisper and they would say, "We have a new man tonight. Don't say anything about God." And you see, I had read the big book because I didn't have any Al-Anon literature to read. And I had read about the wives and the family afterward. And I had read those first four chapters that so many people weren't reading at that time. And it talked about God. And it talked about God being a real basis for this program, a higher power at any rate. And I wondered why they didn't want that new person to know about it, you know. But I would hear this over and over at that time in the 60s. When they finally got Al-Anon, I didn't know anything was wrong with me. My husband was sober and had been for 6 months. And he was happy. He was smiling. And we were traveling all over the place to go to different groups. We went to Tuscaloosa, went to Birmingham, went to Mississippi, came to Atlanta. We were visiting other groups. I was having the time of my life. What I had prayed for had happened. My husband had gotten sober. But I didn't do anything about praying. For 7 years, 7.5 years, Jim remained sober. And I enjoyed every minute of the program. I loved the AAs and the Al-Anons that I met and the Al-Ateens that I met. Loved them all. Didn't change Fran one bit because I didn't know I needed to be changed. After 7.5 years, Jim came in one morning. He was prospering. You know, most AAs do when they get sober. They're such dynamic people. And he had been made president of a company, and he was traveling one or two nights a week, and you've already guessed what happened. He came in and he said, "Fran, for the last few months, I've been drinking on the road, and I just have to tell you. And do you know, I did not have enough Al-Anon to do anything except get sick. Sick, sick, sick. I was like something that went back into a cocoon. I didn't want to see anybody. I didn't want to talk to anybody. The program did not work after all. And it never occurred to me that I was not working the program. I quit going to church for the first time in my life. I quit going to Al-Anon. Arch came to see me. I told her I knew that part of my life was over. And I gave her all my little butterflies that we wore at that time. Jim's sponsors went to see him regularly, and he'd get mad when they'd come. And then they wouldn't come, and he'd get mad when they didn't come. He was just flat miserable. He was the most unhappy person I have ever seen in my life. And I didn't have enough of Al-Anon to know how to handle it, and I didn't handle it too well. And one day I was at Katie and Jim R's, who are both AAs in Bessemer and had been friends of mine from the very first. And I was fussing and I was complaining. And when I started to leave, Jim R. said to me, "Fran, you need to go back to Al-Anon." Thank God he said it. And on the way home, I thought, that really is what I need. There's nobody else I can talk to except people in the program. They're the only ones who know how I'm feeling. They're the only ones I'll open up to. And so that Thursday night, I went back to Al-Anon. And that Sunday, I went back to church because I personally needed both. I had been out almost 4 years. And when I went back, they greeted me. They were flourishing. They had hardback books. They had pamphlets. Boy, had they grown. And I grabbed all that stuff. And I read every single word. Boy, I just absorbed it like a sponge. I needed this. This was my lifeline, and I knew it. And I got a sponsor. Some of you may know Mickey H. from Oneonta, Alabama, and Jim H. Mickey was my sponsor, and she was a rough one, and she started leading me through the steps. And we spent a whole weekend together taking step five. I had a little trouble with step three. I didn't want to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I was afraid he might send me to India as a missionary. And I didn't want to go. I did have trouble with that. And slowly, I started to grow in the program. I was afraid to say anything. I knew I didn't know anything. So for a solid year, I just sat there in the meetings, up on the front row, next to Ada, and listened and learned. And you shared with me, and I needed it so desperately. Jim would never say, "I don't want you to go to Al-Anon." Oh, I told him I was going. And I'm sure that I insinuated that he should be going too. But he never did say, "I don't want you to go." But he would invite me somewhere special every Thursday night. "I will take you to dinner at so-and-so, my favorite place. I will take you to that movie you've been wanting to see. Let's go bowling," you know, whatever. Things I like to do. But never, one single time, did I give up my Al-Anon group meeting. I knew I had to have it. I really stuck in there. And I stuck in there for two solid years, and I was starting to grow. And these Al-Anons told me so many things. And I had learned so much about me that I did not know. I had learned about my character defects. And boy, did I have them. I'm still working on them. But anyway, they told me, "Friend, be good to yourself. Be good to yourself." Hey, nobody had ever told me that. You know, I'd given up things for the kids when I had to. I wouldn't buy anything new for me because they needed something new. And they said, "If you feel like you need something, go get it. You'll work it. You know, you don't even have to give him your check." Hey. How about that? This girl with a master's degree was learning things. So I immediately took my next check and opened my own account. And then I had money to spend. I took art lessons because I'd always wanted to. And I have no great talent, but it's fun. I lost 30 pounds. They said, "Be good to me." That's what I needed to do. I had eaten too much during those drunk days. So I got it off. I went to Europe and left him home. He ruined a whole load of sport shirts trying to wash them. He missed me, I think. When I came back home, he had papered two of the bathrooms with 1,000,000 butterflies. And I thought, that's sweet of him to do that. You know, these Al-Anons had told me to detach from the illness. I didn't know how. When I first started, I turned my back. And I know that they could tell by what I said at meetings that I had turned my back. And they said, "Friend, that's not what we mean. Detach with love. Detach from the illness, but don't detach from Jim if you love him." And I did. And I said, "I don't know how to do that." And they said, "Do little thoughtful things for him. But don't let the fact that he's drinking get you down. Go on and plan things for yourself and the children and invite him to go. But if he doesn't go, you go anyway. Don't change your plans." Slowly, slowly, they guided me through this detachment. And finally, I learned to do it with love and to let Jim know that I cared about him. I would make him a special dinner that he liked. I would go out and buy a new negligee. I did some of those loving things, and he started looking at me funny. What is going on with this kid? She never acted like this before. I started to smile because I was finding some peace and serenity inside me that did not depend on any other person in the world, no matter how much I loved them. And that's what we have to do. We have to do that. And it's hard to do. The Al-Anon program is not easy. You have to work on it diligently, one day at a time, but every day. I started to change, and Jim saw it. And I started feeling a gradual change in him. But he was still drinking. And I didn't realize that he could not stop at that point. I went back to see Katie and Jim one day. And I was telling them in a different way what was going on with Jim. I wasn't screaming and complaining anymore. But I felt a great deal of sorrow that this man I loved so much was still finding it necessary to drink. And I knew that he had a disease that was going to kill him. And when I started to leave, Jim R. said to me, "Fran, we're having a meeting on the 10th step tonight. Tell Big Jim he needs to be there." He was big then. So I said, "Sure, Jim." All the way home, I thought, I'm not going to tell him that. I know exactly what he'll do. He'll shrug his shoulders and walk back to the bedroom, and that'll be the end of it. That night, I was cooking dinner in the kitchen. I heard the key in the front door, and I flew to the front door, and I couldn't tell him fast enough what Jim said. There I go, so predictable. I was right. He shrugged his shoulders and walked back to the bedroom, didn't say a word. And I thought, he is not going to rain on my parade. That's okay. I haven't lost anything. I did what Jim suggested I do, and it's okay. And I went on in the kitchen, and I was stirring a little harder than usual, you know. And he walked in, and he had on a clean shirt. And I said, "Oh, where are you going?" And he said, "I'm going to AA, and don't you cry." Because, you know, I was a crier. I cried at bad things, and I cried at good things. I just spilled over all the time. And I let him get out the door, and then I squalled. I cried. And then I'd stop and dance. And I'd shout. And I was the craziest thing you ever saw. But I had always known that if he made up his mind that he wanted to be sober again, it would be for good, or for that he would mean it to be for good. I know that nobody's cured. Okay. I called our children. One was in college. Two were out of college and married. Good kids. I called our children and told them that their dad had gone to AA. Oh, they were so happy. They loved their dad. And they had had enough of the program to know that he was sick and needed help. And they were so happy. And he came home that night, and he had a smile on his face and a look in his eyes that I hadn't seen for a long time. And that was 10 years ago. They told me 2 years after that that I had 30 years of teaching school in, and I could retire. And my retirement was going to be great, within $100 of my salary. So I said, "Well, hey, that's great. I can paint, and I can watch soap operas, and I can learn to play bridge, and I can do these things that women do." So for a week, I did that. Now, you know, you can't work 30 years and just drop it all. You got to do something. There's something that's got to be in there. I went to meetings all over the place, and I didn't know what to do with myself. And I thought, "Hey, kid, you don't have to decide this by yourself. Haven't you learned anything in Al-Anon? Do you walk the way you talk?" And so I sat down and had a talk with God about it. And because I had learned to talk to him just, you know, as I did any friend, It was not morning and evening like it had been before, but it was sort of all day long as things happened. Help me with this. Thank you for that. And I said, well, here I am a week later, and I believe I might have made a mistake. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm crazy. What am I going to do the rest of my life? If there's something that you would like for me to do, will you please guide me so that I will know it? But you better hit me kind of hard with it, because I don't always pay attention, you know. So that Thursday I was in the beauty shop, and I was sitting under a dryer reading a magazine, not thinking about God at all. And this lady came up and hit my dryer. And she lifted it up and she said, do you have a master's in administration? And you know, nobody had ever asked me that in the beauty shop and anywhere else, I don't think. And I thought, what? And I thought, oh, yeah, that's what I have. And I said, yes, I do. I never had used it. I'd always taught English in high school. But here I had it. And she said, you're the one we've been praying for. And boy, that sounded serious. And I thought, I wonder if he's going to send me to India after all. And I said, what have you got in mind? And she said, we've been looking for a principal of our parochial school, and I think you'd be perfect. And I said, oh, I can't do that. I'm not Catholic. I'm Methodist. You know, we argue with God all the way. Here I was being pulled along, screaming and kicking because I wasn't Catholic. And she said, will you come and talk to the priest? And I said, oh, yes, I will. So I went to talk to him, and he was a big, fat fellow, jolly fellow. He said, young lady, I understand that you're thinking of not coming with us because you're Methodist. I said, yes, sir. He said, well, now, if you were Baptist, I could understand that. He said, I don't want you to teach religion. I want you to run the school. I said, well, I think I can do that. So I have just finished 8 years of running the school. Boy, has it been fun. I have the little bitty ones from kindergarten through eighth grade, and they're so darling. It has been such a pleasure. Our problems in high school were alcohol, drugs, unmarried pregnant mothers, so on. Our biggest problem is chewing gum. And God and I are handling that, okay. I get lots of hugs and lots of little notes with Valentine's drawn on them. I love those children and they love me and we have a ball. God got me that job. I didn't even know about it. Knew nothing about it. And I got a retirement and I got a great paycheck, bigger than any I'd ever made. And I had something to do that I loved. Don't be afraid to turn your life over to the care of your higher power. He wants more for you than you want for yourself. And you don't have to go to India. It was terrific. Jim was working his program, and I was working my program, and we were so happy. And I got into service, and he got into service. And I did everything they told me to do, because I was so grateful to be there. I washed dishes for a long time. Occasionally, I still do. I was in charge of programs. I worked hard on my programs. I didn't go in and say, now we're going to talk about anything you want to talk about. I needed to have something planned. I didn't take my little one day at a time and read pages of it all night. I worked hard on my programs, as we should do in Al-Anon. We need to help people who need help and who are there early in the program. It was one of the great joys, and it still is, to have a new... there to greet them and to feed her. God didn't promise us a rose garden. No way. We grow through these things that happen to us. And thank God, in our program, we have a way to handle them. We have learned to accept the things we cannot change. It took me a long time to know what that meant. It didn't mean that I had to be voting for it. It simply meant that this thing had happened, or was going to happen, and I accepted it as a fact. It didn't mean I liked it or loved it. It meant that I accepted it and was going to learn to live with whatever it was. And I have had to do a lot of that. Our 17-year-old granddaughter, the one who was born while my daughter was going to, well, she had stopped college, and then she had this baby, and then she wanted to go back to college, so we took her and the baby to live with us. She had gotten a divorce. And so that baby lived with us for 3 years, and she was like our own little bitty girl, and we loved her so much, and she was so bright. She was so receptive to the love we all gave her. And she was 17 now, and she was killed in an accident here in Atlanta 3 years ago this summer. And it almost broke our heart. But we had Al-Anons and AAs and Alateens around us. And we had our programs to live by, and we had our higher power that we could go to. And we got through it. And her mother, our firstborn, who was born while Jim was overseas, Jane, would write me and say, "You tell me it's going to get better, but it's not getting better. It's getting worse. Every day it's getting worse." And she saw doctors, and she went to Compassionate Friends, and she did whatever we could hear of or think of to make her better. And I don't think that any of us realized that she was as sick as she was, and 2 years ago she killed herself. This was very, very hard. We kept saying, why? She had gotten her master's degree. She was teaching. She had so much going for her. But she had so much despair in her life that she was unable to face the next day. And she was really, really sick. And we had to accept that fact. Our son, our lovely son that we love so much, started drinking socially. Whatever that is. And his wife, who taught fourth grade, came to me and said, "I know you know about this, but he stays out sometimes till 1 o'clock in the morning." So I got Ann a lot of literature, and I talked to her. It's hard to work with people who are too close to you, though. Sometimes you better turn them over to somebody else. But I spent some time talking to Ann, and she went to a few meetings with me. And one day she came in and she said, "I'm changing all the locks on all the doors, and he's not getting back in." So I called Jimmy, and I said, "Come by," and he did. And as soon as he walked in the door, I burst into tears. And he said, "Mother, what on earth is wrong?" And I told him, I said, "You're going to lose Ann." "No, I'm not. You know I'm not. You're just taking this too seriously." And I said, "It is serious." Well, that day he went by to see his dad, and he's been sober 3.5 years. Hope I don't start, but almost did. He loves AA too. We are so glad that that program was here for him when he needed it. Our youngest daughter is a workaholic. She got her doctor's degree 2 years ago before she was 30. She has a big job, making a lot more money than I ever have. Very, very successful with 2 darling little boys. We have 6 grandchildren, and we lost 2. We know that God of our understanding has been so good to us. I owe anything I have to the programs of AA and Al-Anon. I thank you for being here for us. We are so very grateful to you. Thank you.